Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
It becomes the sad duty tonight for those of us normally concerned with the lighter side of television reporting to deal with a somber subject. First of all, of course, our sympathies go to the families of those concerned. But what exactly happened? And vitally important, why?
Whenever I think of that game and that time, those two events are so entwined.
Out it goes to Lee Dixon. Long ball from Lee Dixon. Smith will hold it up, plays it square to Thomas, and Thomas goes inside Nicol, and Thomas is there, and Thomas has scored for Arsenal!
It was a very, very, very unusual and very emotional set of circumstances, not just because of what happened on the night, but also because of the Hillsborough disaster.
Thomas was there, he held off two challenges, kept his head. By my watch, we are a minute and a half into injury time, and Michael Thomas may have won the championship for Arsenal.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Joining myself and Jonathan Wilson today is Amy Lawrence, football writer for The Athletic and author of a number of books, including The Wenger Revolution, 20 Years of Arsenal, and most recently, 89, Arsenal's Greatest Moment, told in our words. Today, we're going all the way back to the 26th of May 1989, the last day of the old Division 1. Arsenal beat Liverpool 2-0 at Anfield to clinch the title. Amy, it's an obvious one, but why have you chosen this game?
I'm a big believer that when certain things happen at a certain point in your life, they have an extra resonance and they impact on you in an extra way. And the circumstances of not just that night, but that moment in time, that season, I was 17 years old. It was my last year of school. It was actually my last day of school on the 26th of May, 1989. So I did bunk off naturally to make sure that I got myself to Anfield. And, I do have this, when I look back at my 17-year-old self, obviously you're at that age where you kind of think you know it all, but you're still exploring the world and you're such a sort of sponge for new experiences and formulating the kind of person you are and what you believe in and what you think is important. And this thing happened, this impossible thing that in many ways, growing up, I was born in 1971 and, my whole childhood was like Arsenal won the league in 1971 and then hadn't done it since. And it was this thing that you think, I wonder if I'll ever see it for myself in my own lifetime. And it happened when I was 17 and still quite impressionable. And it was a very, very, very unusual and very emotional set of circumstances, not just because of what happened on the night, but also because of the Hillsborough disaster. And whenever I think of that game and that time, those two events are so entwined. And I still find it something that almost gives me shivers down my spine when I think that in 40-odd years of watching football and being obsessed by football and immersed in football, the two most extreme emotions I've ever had occurred within about 5-6 weeks of each other, which was Hillsborough and then the 26th of May 1989 when the impossible happened in a football match involving my team.
The film The Fever Pitch actually gets that across very well, doesn't it? The scene of him sort of sitting in his front room, sort of watching Hillsborough unfold on the TV and sort of trying to process that. That was almost exactly, obviously significantly younger than the Nick Hornby character, but that was almost exactly my experience of it, of how can this thing that sort of has become part of my life, that I go every Saturday, how can it do this? And then, the complete sort of contrast 6 weeks later.
Yeah, and I mean, in many ways, it was... The Hillsborough thing was so difficult for us all to process, and it still is in many ways. It's 30 years on, and you still find yourself, whenever those images come up on TV or something, it is that moment where you're almost paralysed by what you're watching and the memories that it evokes. And
well, in that sort I think of the sense, other thing I was, think that sense it could have been any of us,
of course,
and you know, it happened to be them, but.
Anybody who went to football then knew it could have been anyone. And I think that's why the ripples of our emotional reaction to it as football fans were felt so strongly. And I think, when you think of major tragedies that happen in life, that you see something on the news of something terrible and awful that happens, that you just, it's terribly upsetting. There's something about, obviously, the Hillsborough disaster that seems to go so deep, I think, in people who went to football then. Compared to, other terrible things that have happened in our lifetimes.
The match was obviously moved, of course, Amy, because of the Hillsborough disaster. The match against Arsenal was moved from the 23rd of April to the 26th of May, as a suitable date couldn't be found before the FA Cup final. So, the Hillsborough disaster was sort of all over this, if you see what I mean.
It wasn't going to happen in this way. It wasn't possible. And the other thing that happened by moving it, and by the fact that they couldn't find a suitable date, was it got moved beyond the regulation season.
Mm.
So it ended up being played on a Friday night, which was extremely unusual in those days. But also, 90 of the 92 teams had finished their season.
Yeah.
So there was only two teams who had one game left to play, who happened to be first and second in the first division, as was then called, who happened to be in a situation where they could end up locked on points and goal difference, which is exactly what happened.
It's such an
insanely unique set of circumstances. People often make the comparison with the Aguero Manchester City title swing, as was that the most dramatic finish in football, and I think there's quite a definitive answer to that, which was that was against QPR, who were relegated. So, but this was
but I take the point.
But the fact that this is head to head,
but the fact that it was like a cup final for the league.
Oh, it was. Yeah.
Presumably, whoever arranged that used some discretion, because Liverpool had played West Ham on the Tuesday.
That's right.
So, I mean, they could have done something utterly stupid and put those two games the other way around.
Mm.
So they obviously thought, yeah, we'll have this as the finale.
As you say, it was like a league playoff to decide. It was the way it went down, and if you try and compare to other title run-ins and so on, it's nothing. This is absolutely extraordinary. And as you say, Jonathan, that must have been in the mind of whoever was arranging those fixtures.
Yeah, and then the fact that Arsenal had to win by two.
Yeah.
Which is, again, that's something you don't get in a cup final. It's something where this is really specific what the task is.
Mm-hmm.
The commentary from Brian Moore at the beginning of the game, he goes, "A night of chilling simplicity." And I think that really sums it up, because it was mathematically very clear what had to happen. And that impacted very obviously, I think, on the way that the game panned out. Because I think had it been a situation where Liverpool had to, get something from the game, but knowing that they could lose 1-0 and win the league... psychologically, especially, not like they hadn't had a huge number of super complicated things to try and psychologically deal with, obviously, in the previous weeks, but that's quite a difficult thing for any sportsman to go into a game knowing that you win even though you don't have to.
And they just won the FA Cup.
They had
the previous Saturday.
And they'd won 18 games in a row.
Well, they'd won 13 of the previous 14 in the league. The other one was a draw against Everton. So, and I have to say, before I sort of looked this up, my sort of assumption had been there'd have been a sort of blip around the immediate post Hillsborough games. But no, in terms of on the pitch, they were absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, and Arsenal hadn't won at Anfield since 74?
That's right.
Yeah, 15 years it was.
Yeah, so.
So, yeah, it's.
Oh, it was a fortress.
It's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. And by two, you know, you can't just, you know, try and hold out and then nick it 1-0. That wouldn't be enough.
And the other thing, just sort of on sort of things that my brain had sort of slightly kind of got wrong. And I guess I knew this, because I knew they had to win by two, because of the goal scored situation. That Arsenal actually had scored, 10 more goals than Liverpool that season?
That's right.
So we think of them as being a very negative 1-0 team. But actually, they were the freest scoring side.
Which is what won them. They won the league on goal scored.
Yeah.
It wasn't even goal difference. Mm. You know, that's how incredibly tight it was. And of course, in this country, that's what you do. In Italy, that would have gone to a playoff, which would have been, I mean, can you imagine that? If we had those rules, that game would have produced another goal. Fortunately, I think that we don't do that. But, I mean, am I right in saying, Amy, Arsenal at one point that season had an 11-point lead over Liverpool.
They had a vast league, I think, just after Christmas, going into New Year. Liverpool were something like fourth or fifth, around Christmas. They weren't actually particularly contenders, and I think that's where it was a very young and quite inexperienced Arsenal team. The only person who had ever won the title in that side was Kevin Richardson, who'd been signed from Watford but had played for Everton when they'd won the league in the mid-80s. And other than that, there was no one in the dressing room who had ever won or come particularly close to winning a title. There was quite a lot of homegrown players who were quite young, and there was a core who had arrived, signed by George Graham from either unfashionable or lower league sides. You know, they weren't really in the business of signing superstars. In fact, George Graham didn't really like superstars. he always used to say, you know, I want performing stars.
Right,
you know? Okay. But that was his, you know, he was a manager who very much believed, obviously going on to form the legendary back four, although they played a back five that night, but all the members of that iconic Arsenal back four were on the pitch that night. Although they weren't known yet as what they was part of what they were turning into. But, you know, they signing Nigel Winterburn from Wimbledon for, I don't know, 350 grand or something, signing Lee Dixon and Steve Bould from Stoke for, you know, buttons, really. Neither of them cost much more than, you know, £500,000. Alan Smith was the luxury signing who cost a little less than £1 million from Leicester City when Leicester were not quite the glamorous side that they are today. So, you know, he was all about getting people, and he wanted people who were going to listen to him and not challenge him. He got rid of Charlie Nicholas and, you know, as Kenny Sansom, sort of experienced international players who, you know, swanned around and were a bit complacent. And he'd very deliberately formed this team that were young and hungry and had desire and wanted to listen to him and would do anything he said.
Mm. And going into that, the game at Anfield, Arsenal, they lost to Derby and drawn with Wimbledon. And again, so you look at the neck and neck. Was there a feeling in among the Arsenal camp that they'd maybe blown it?
Very much so. I think the only person who didn't buy into that was Tony Adams. And he was like, nah, come on, I thought we'd do it. But having spoken to, you know, many of the players and people involved in that night, I think at the end of the Wimbledon game, it was classic party pooper stuff. Arsenal were winning 2-1. This was in the penultimate game of the season. And a guy called McGinn, who played for Wimbledon, I think it was his debut, and I don't think he played much after that. He sort of came from nowhere and disappeared into obscurity and scored this goal that made it 2-2, that made Arsenal's task sort of suddenly really difficult. And I remember being in the North Bank that night, and there was a lap of honour. So it was the last home game of the season. It was very rueful. You know, everybody was applauding, but I think the players felt, you know, really crushed and almost embarrassed that they'd blown it. And the fans' feeling was very much kind of like, well, you know, well done for having given it a great shot this year, but, you know, let's see what next year holds. I don't think at that point in time there was a feeling that, right, Arsenal can go to Anfield and do it on the last day. That sort of defiance grew quite quietly from within the camp in the days that followed.
Well, you can sort of sense that George Graham played on that by, I mean, just doing the research for this, I've watched a handful of interviews on YouTube. And
there was quite a good film about it, I must say.
Well.
Sorry.
Yeah.
There's lots of detail in there.
Great. I haven't seen it, sorry. I will dig it up in the next couple of days. But you watched, so George Graham and David O'Leary, particularly in these interviews, saying, people said we're just wasting the train fare coming up here. Yeah, there was no point us even turning up. Clearly nobody said that. Everybody was going, this is brilliant, it's a title decider. But I can see why, in terms of generating this sort of siege mentality, in terms of making out the 15 years of not winning at Anfield, making out it didn't matter, making out the fact that the stutter that had gone on for, what, 3 or 4 months didn't matter.
I think you say nobody said that. I mean, one national newspaper ran the headline, "You haven't got a prayer, Arsenal." So there was...
I mean, yeah.
They might have ramped it up, but certainly, I mean, but nobody gave Arsenal a chance here.
It's one thing to sort of say that in sort of tabloid ease that you think Liverpool will win it. It's another thing to say that this is a waste of time.
What, you haven't got a prayer, would suggest?
Ah, come on, that's tabloid ease for Liverpool might nick it 1-0.
No, is that right?
I don't think there were many newspapers at the time that were, giving positive spin that Arsenal did have much of a prayer, to be honest, from my memory, but... George Graham really gave a masterclass, I think, in between the kind of calamity of them dropping 5 points at home to Derby and Wimbledon and going up to Anfield. And first of all, gave him some time off. And then I think he might have encouraged them to go off to the races or what have you.
Yeah, right.
Get up to a bit of no good and let off a bit of steam, and which he could do in those days without it being sort of too exposing, I think. And he then really kept things very, very light. The players have all mentioned how at the training ground the mood was quite buoyant, quite relaxed. There wasn't a kind of a come on tunnel vision siege mentality thing going on. It was quite the opposite. I think George Graham's approach was to really do everything he could psychologically to take the pressure off them. And what he did, the thing he did that was most surprising is normally for a game, an evening game of that nature, you wouldn't be travelling up on the day. You'd go up the day before, you'd have a night in a hotel. You'd get up the next day and maybe have a stroll around town and your pre-match meal and a little rest and all that stuff. But he said, right, we travel on the day of the game. So this is the biggest game for 18 years. And they rearranged the whole transport, etc., to take the coach up on the Friday morning. And, the seats on the bus were hard to come by. There was people who turned up who wanted to go up to Anfield, like directors, and had nothing, no business being anyone there. And who was sitting in, one of the top players' seats. And it was like, excuse me. It was all a bit kind of crackers. But there was this real air of calm that was generated by sort of changing the plans in that way. And I think that was a big help. They all the players seemed to have this feeling. The other thing, though, of course, that happened that, in hindsight, seems remarkable, is that George Graham in his pre-match talks pretty much read the script.
Mm-hmm.
His entire tactical approach to this was, everybody thinks we've got to go out there, go gung-ho, play extra forwards, throw everything at them. We've got to score 2 goals at Anfield. No. 0-0 half-time, please.
Yeah, I mean,
that was his instructions.
And Brian Moore in the on the commentary when he's reading out the team, he expressed a surprise. Oh, Steve Bold's playing. They're playing a back three. Mm. You'd have thought they'd have wanted more forwards on the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll just take a quick break, Amy, and then we will talk about the game after this.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to The Greatest Games, everybody. Right, let's get into the game. We've taken a big old run-up at it, and you're right in saying that Arsenal, they needed to win by 2 goals, so they went for a back five.
That's right. This was the classic George Graham. But he insists it was a back three. He insists it was. There was two reasons for it. Liverpool being Liverpool, having the phenomenon of John Barnes, who was probably the best player in the league on one wing, and Ray Houghton on the other, who was extremely dangerous. It was all about cutting off the supply lines so that, you know, that Ian Rush and Beardsley or Aldridge or whoever were not getting chances, because so much of Liverpool's game came down those flanks.
Yeah, Rush and Aldridge started, and then Rush was injured after 32 minutes and Beardsley came on. Mm. So
George's idea was Dixon and Winterburn push right up and stop...
pin the wingers back.
Pin the wingers back. And then the three centre-backs would sort of try and outnumber and comfortably deal with the strikers. That was the plan. And it was 0-0 half-time, please. Then, you know, they might get a little bit nervous. Get one goal, you know, in the second half, and then watch them start to panic a bit, and that's where you can get another one. So that was exactly what he said before the game.
There was that very good chance. Yeah, Steve Bould almost scored, didn't he?
In the first half.
Extraordinary clearance from Steve Nicol.
Yeah, probably did Arsenal a favour, really, because
he might have been too early.
We should mention. You were saying that you didn't get in for kickoff. I mean, kickoff was delayed.
It was,
yeah. That's
as if right. As if the drama couldn't be ramped up a bit more. Kickoff is delayed because of a lot of traffic.
There was an insane traffic jam.
Basically. How did you get up there? Did you drive?
Travel club coaches. There were 25 coaches, although there wasn't a coach number 13. I'm told and it was a convoy of coaches that left Highbury around about midday-ish, which should have been plenty of time to get there for an 8 o'clock kickoff.
What was the feeling like among the fans?
Really optimistic.
Really?
Honestly, very positive. It was a boiling day. Everybody felt great. And the other thing that I remember very vividly was this sense of the community and of everybody kind of being out to try and... It was almost like an army was going off and people were trying to sort of give them a good send-off.
People waving at the windows.
Yeah, honestly, we drove past a school on Drayton Park just by the state, just to go around the corner from the stadium, and they've got like a lifeboat in the playground. And they were all up on the lifeboat screaming, all these kids. And then we drove past, I remember seeing four old ladies all bedecked in like rosettes and stuff on their balconies waving. And there was people honking their horns at the coaches and all the way up the sort of Holloway Road. It felt like the whole of like North London was like, come on.
It was like you were the team. It was like you were
deflating
parts. It
was very bizarre. I mean, considering we weren't doing anything that would affect the result, obviously. But yeah, there was just this vibe. It was difficult to explain, but like something special could happen.
Yeah.
I didn't get the feeling of hopelessness for some, you know, which totally goes against the "you haven't got a prayer" Arsenal headlines and so on. Obviously, outside the bubble, you can imagine everyone else thinking, well, Liverpool are going to coast this, then that's fine. And you sit down to watch a game thinking that if you don't have a vested interest as a neutral. But it seemed like within the kind of core of the community and of the club that everybody thought, well, come on then, let's see what we can do.
The calmness of George Graham you've spoken about, he said before the game, as long as we can keep a clean sheet or keep them out for a long period of the game, then we've got a chance. And that you know, goes into the point of playing sort of a back five. And David O'Leary, the only non-Englishman in the side, deployed as a sweeper, which wasn't his normal position for Arsenal.
No, they'd done it by memory once before that season. Yeah. I mean, they were absolutely a back four team. They were 4-4-2 all season, except for that because they was with this tactic was designed specifically for Liverpool. And the game before the original game against Liverpool that was scheduled on April 23rd, Arsenal played Manchester United at Old Trafford or a couple of games before. It was a sort of, Graham regarded it as a good warm-up. Similar, up north, you know, big team, although Man United were nowhere as good as Liverpool that era. So they did it for that game. They did it as a practice match. And that was a game where Arsenal drew 1-1 and Adam scored in both ends. It was pouring with rain and quite late on, he kind of lunged at a ball coming across and it skidded off and took a deflection and looped over John Lukic's head. And all the Eeyore stuff was in the papers the following day. Mm. So that was kind of interesting sort of side issue when you're reflecting on those kind of times. Although someone pointed out recently that back then, kind of anyone would get Eeyore, yeah, if they did something stupid. I mean, they really laid it on thick with Adams at that particular moment, but it could be at any game then if someone tabloids didn't have
they didn't have as much of a repertoire as they do now, perhaps, you know.
maybe. But anyway, so they had one practice, but other than that, it, you know, it was all designed about, specifically Liverpool away.
So as we say, they got to half-time 0-0. So the plan's going, it's going according to plan. And then in the second half, Alan Smith scores the first goal. And
so 7 minutes into the second half.
7 minutes into the
an indirect free kick.
Yeah. Which he gets his head onto.
Yeah, a very fine glancing header.
Liverpool players protested quite vehemently.
Which I think suggests they were really rattled by that.
Yeah.
Because it's really, really hard to understand what they were complaining about, because a touch is a low slight. It's pretty obvious. There was no sort of shove or anything.
Well, I think the referee said, didn't he, years later when he was, some time after the game, he felt that, he said that the Liverpool players didn't really know what they were protesting about. Is that right, Amy? Is there?
Yeah, the referee was, he was a lovely fellow, Dave Hutchinson. He did feel that he was just surrounded. There was a kind of a series of things that were being thrown at him. It was like, was it offside? Was it, you know, that they didn't get a touch? You know, it could have been sort of almost anything. Was there a foul somewhere? So he had a very specific routine that he would always do at games, which was essentially to buy himself some time if things were difficult, which was go and see his linesman. And one of the details that I discovered that has always kind of struck me as remarkable for a game of this sort of stature is that the referee and his two linesmen had never met before this match and never worked again either.
Was that right?
A single game together.
Yeah.
So they were sort of thrown together for this match and they met in the afternoon and had to develop a rapport. And the referee spent some time explaining exactly how he, you know, if I look at you, you know, with help written all over my face, you know, like just give me a chance, I'll come and talk to you and we'll try and take the pressure off. And so he went over to talk to his linesman and basically asked them, you know, clear questions. It was an indirect free kick. Did Alan Smith get touched? And the linesman said, yes. Was it offside? No. Was there any obstruction or foul? No. So then he gave the goal. But I mean, it did seem to go on for ages. And I think there's a bit of panic
there. The camera's right there as well. So anybody who can lip read, you can presumably follow what that camera. Certainly you can see the linesman's face. Mm. Maybe the referee slightly angled away. But anyway, I was trying to lip read it. And the first, you know, the look on the linesman's face initially is just sort of surprise. What? I don't know. I don't even know what question I'm going to get asked here. And then you see sort of he relaxes because obviously this routine of kind of pretty basic questions, which you can just sort of go, fine, that's fine, also fine. Mm.
But a hell of a decision to make, well, or to potentially make in that kind of atmosphere. You've got Liverpool players surrounding you and the crowd and so on and so forth. But the goal was given and it was 1-0 to Arsenal. And it seemed to be 1-0 when you watch that game back. And I don't know how you felt in the stands, Amy. It seemed to be 1-0 for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would say about being is it was so engrossed in the game, and I don't think there was a clock, actually, if memory serves, on the scoreboard at Anfield. And I definitely remember not knowing what time it was at all, and I never.
Which is a weird thing, isn't it?
I didn't know how late.
That definitely happened quite a lot. Yeah, it seems such an obvious thing. You put a clock there. But I remember, I was sort of thinking, you know, Rucker Park was one clock, but it was like, you know, an analogue clock. So you didn't really know, because did it start at 3?
To be fair, Highbury Stadium was a world leader in having a clock.
Having a clock, yeah. But that wasn't a digital clock, was
it?
Was
true,
it?
Yeah.
But there's something that happened that night, as far as the TV broadcast that was concerned, that was a beginning of something. That in that TV broadcasts back then, and this was, I think, the first year of the football deal where they were showing live football, ITV in one of the original TV deals, and there was no clock and there was no score. on the screen. Mm-hmm. Screens were bare apart from the action. And the producer on the night, when it got quite late in the game, I think it got to about 85 minutes or so, they had a discussion about putting a clock up, putting the little clock that they could see in the TV production area for the world out there to see how long there was to go. And there was some, you know, high level debate going on where the producer was saying to, you know, the director or the head of sport, let's put up the clock. Yeah. And they said, no, it'll look shit. They said, don't care if it'll look shit. People need to know what time it is. Yeah. And that was the first time that a clock was used.
Yeah, it was previously, they sort of, every sort of quarter of an hour, they'd have sort of a
time check.
Yeah, you know, the picture of a clock with sort of quarter of an hour marked off and then whatever the score was. And that would be it. But yeah, because it struck me watching it that for that time, it looked really weird to have this. Because you know when McMahon does that weird thing where he, I think a free kick's played short. Yeah, well, that's actually before this, yeah. So there's I think Richardson's down with cramp.
That's right.
Which is also a weird thing. Like, it's almost like he's wasting Arsenal's time. Yeah. He's down for ages with cramp. Just get off the pitch.
To be fair, he must really have cramp. Do you know what I mean? Of all the people, of all the injuries that weren't faked, you could say it was that one.
So yeah, there's the incident of... you see Aldridge and Barnes just do a little handshake, sort of keep it going. McMahon raises one finger, goes, 1 minute left. But then there's a short free kick play to McMahon who does this sort of weird little shimmy where he goes through three Arsenal players to play the back pass.
Yeah, yeah.
And as he does that, it's 90-26 on the clock. And there's still sort of 2 or 3 minutes to go.
But it's extraordinary, though, because the sides back then were known for time-wasting with the back pass rule hadn't been introduced. So, again... If you're playing, you can't sort of emphasise this enough. If you're playing that Liverpool side at Anfield, you need to score. They're absolutely fine. And the back pass rule hasn't been introduced. You've got a hell of a task on your hands to get that second goal. And there's a moment after what you've just described.
So from that McMahon back pass,
yeah.
Grobbelaar rolls it to, who was it? Would it have been Steve Staunton?
Could have been.
Who then knocks it back to him. And then he kicks long. He didn't have to.
Yeah.
But he obviously said, you wanted enough. We're starting to take the piss if we could do more than that.
Yeah, but
you could have done.
Yes, but the real absolute defining moment is when John Barnes goes off to the corner
flag. Absolutely.
Goes off and he looks like he's heading to the corner flag. Yeah. And then he
turns infield
and has a go. And that was really the game changer because...
Is that his David Ginola moment?
Or well,
was
actually, David even before that, there'd been a ball played needlessly into the box, which I think Adams had intercepted.
Mm-hmm.
Then Adams' pass out was poor and Barnes picks up again.
Yeah.
So he's had two chances to waste time and he hasn't taken either of them.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, in a way, I think that's beautiful because everything about the player that John Barnes was that Liverpool was.
True enough.
Which was, it wasn't really in their instinctive nature. They were a phenomenal footballing
side. Well, but by then it wasn't in their nature. Yeah, the previous season had been, I think, the most attacking Liverpool we'd ever seen, certainly since Shankly took over. That 87-8 season when they had Houghton and Barnes and Beardsley had all come in and they were playing absolutely extraordinary football. Yeah, the Shankly Paisley years were very pragmatic. Which is fine. Yeah, it's a perfect.
Yeah, but by 88 they were the best team we'd ever seen, felt like.
So yeah, they were a much more attacking side. Yeah.
Before we get onto the goal, just to turn that clock back a few minutes. Thomas had a chance, didn't he, to make it 2-0?
He hates talking about it.
Does he?
To this day.
Why?
When people bring up that chance that he missed.
Yeah. But surely the way the game panned out, I would think it would...
Well, again, a bit like you talked about the bold chance at the beginning. I think if that goes in with 15 minutes to go, then Liverpool respond. It's too long.
I completely agree.
With the benefit of hindsight, it's the right thing for Arsenal.
So there's a through ball from Kevin Richardson. Thomas runs on. He sort of stabs the shot a bit, yeah. And Grobbelaar is just in the way of it.
Was the feeling in the crowd, was that kind of, that was our chance?
I have to tell you again, I don't know what time it was. I was just so... there aren't that many games I can think of where I was so in... You were almost like you felt like you were on the pitch. I can't explain it properly. It was quite surreal. But it was like watching a game with specific blinkers where you really have no idea what's going on, like 1 centimetre away from what you're looking at on the pitch. And it just, you were just so absorbed that no idea. Obviously, you don't think you're going to have loads of chances to score, but I didn't think, oh my God, that was it, it's getting late or anything like that.
I'm surprised he's still bothered by that, because there's two lovely moments left in the game that involved him very much. Mm. And the obvious one is the goal, of course. So, I mean, John, I suppose you'd talk us through what happened there.
So Barnes is tackled by Kevin Richardson.
Yes.
And then comes to Lee Dixon, sort of in a classic right back slot.
No, it goes back to John Lukic.
It does, yeah.
And this is another big moment where Lukic, everybody thinks you need a goal, it's stoppage time, and you know, just launch it, and he throws it to Dixon. Dixon didn't want the ball.
Yeah. Playing out from the back.
He was running. Well, but the John Lukic's explanation from that is brilliant, where he said that as soon as Alan Smith had scored in that second half, they'd been so obsessed about keep it 0-0, don't concede a goal. Suddenly the everything changed where they need another goal. And now he said it was even more important they don't concede.
Mm.
And he said he went into this kind of state of elevated concentration, like he'd never concentrated like that ever in his life. And by the end, he was so tired, obviously a mental tiredness, not he hadn't been that physically active. He said, if I'm kicking this, it's not getting out of the box. And that's why he threw it to Dixon.
Amazing.
And anyway, then Dixon thinks, I've only got one ball here and I'll just do what I always do, which is same for Alan Smith, because he'll be able to control anything.
And Smith does brilliantly to take it down, and then sort of the ball sort of bundles past Alan Hansen, and suddenly from absolutely nowhere, there's Thomas clean through.
And what I love about that, though, is when Thomas, as you say, it sort of bundles his way through, when he gets it, the pressure in that situation, he takes a touch. If I'm honest with you, I almost think he takes one extra touch too much. He takes his time in front of goal, considering that chance that he'd missed before. You'd think perhaps that he would maybe lash it or something. And even watching the clip back, you think, hurry up, man, they're going to catch you.
But do you not think that the chance he missed is why he does that? He knows he sort of, it was the first finish was this sort of horrible, stabby, nervy, just kick it towards the goal.
Yeah.
This one, it was sort of,
I'll take my time.
And he waits for Grobbelaar to start to commit going to his right and hits it back across Grobbelaar's legs. Brilliant. You see it from behind the goal. It's absolutely brilliant.
It's a marvellous finish. But I mean, Amy, like that, when he goes through on goal, again, the touches he's taken, it does seem quite a long time, again, from that touch when he puts himself on goal to actually putting the ball in the net.
Well, the amazing thing was that if you speak to any of his teammates, they will all say the same thing like a chorus, which is, if there was any man to take that shot, it was Mickey Thomas.
Really?
Right. Yeah. And the reason for that is that he was so placid and so calm that he didn't panic, and anybody else would have done. And Paul Merson said, he literally said, if it was me, I would have shat myself. You know, he was so almost relieved but they really felt like he was the only person that could have managed that situation.
Mm.
And the other thing they said about him is that if he would have missed, he would have handled it, which obviously a lot of other people would have struggled with. Mm. You know, if you'd have been the man who.
Yeah, I would have been. Yeah, you pointed at me, but yeah.
but he was. I think he just felt it was weird. He says that when he'd missed that chance before, he almost had this kind of zen-like feeling: "As I'll have another go, I'll get another chance." It was like he felt some sort of destiny thing going on. And I think when he was through, it was just, as he describes it, you know, a game of poker, a cat and mouse. He wanted to wait for Grobbelaar. Grobbelaar wanted to wait for Thomas. They were both waiting for the other one to make the first move, and he held his nerve. And what's the most amazing thing is when you watch it on super slow-mo, you notice how close Ray Houghton's boot is to tackling him. You know, there is a photograph that a friend of mine took that looks like Houghton's got the ball. That's how close it is. You almost look at that and you think, well, it's not possible that he didn't actually get tackled there, because it looks like his foot's actually mostly on the ball.
And that photo sums up the season, really. Yeah. It sounds like that finale just... how it's the margin of the margin,
and that, my friends, is why you never give up
or never leave a game early.
Yeah,
and so Arsenal, they score, pandemonium, of course. I can't even imagine the scenes in the away end, but like I say, there was two moments with Michael Thomas, and the second one is he controls the ball in his own box when Liverpool, straight from kickoff, are like, right, oh my goodness, we have to attack, we've got to go forward, bomb on. The ball comes into the box and Thomas ends up, and he has players around him taking a nice little touch and just calmly rolling it back to John Lukic, almost sort of playing Liverpool at their own tactic as well. It's, I mean, that shows, it goes into what you're saying about how calm the man was. You know, an amazing moment, really, considering the situation.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, yeah, like you say, there's almost a kind of triptych of moments involving Thomas in that last 15 minutes. And, you know, they were all highly influential and you could analyse each of them to death, really.
Yeah. I mean, Jonathan, when you saw the game and you saw that second goal going in, what did you think?
Well, I was watching it at home with my dad, I think. So obviously my dad went, it's not the same as 73 though, is it? which actually, no, but on a more universal point, when the final whistle went in the 73 Cup final, my dad said, having spent, you know, essentially, yeah, 25 minutes whistling for the final whistle, his immediate reaction when the final whistle actually did go was sadness because he knew he'd never be that good again. He was 35 at the time, so he'd seen a bit more. But did a 17-year-old you have
100%? I mean, not that moment.
Really?
Yeah, but I remember getting up the next day and just seeing the papers, and somehow seeing it written out makes something more real because you're in this kind of weird hallucinogenic sort of state.
So you got the coach down that night.
Got the coach back down.
That must have been amazing.
Night. There was some weird psychedelic Greek music on the coach.
But everyone must have been going mental, surely.
Well, it was kind of
a combination. Was everybody exhausted?
It was both, really. I think it was a mixture. It seemed to go quite quick. And we got back, and my friends who I went with, her mum had written a banner that she put on the front door that said Arsenal champions. It was seeing it that was like, that was almost sort of a, I don't know, it made it real somehow. And then we went and got the video and watched it. And that was really weird because watching it again and seeing how late it was, honestly, I thought that was about 15, 20 minutes ago at the time when Tom scored at the time. Had no clue until we actually saw it again. And the next day getting all the papers, I do remember sitting there thinking, well, that's it. Like, I don't think life gets any better than this. But I didn't feel sad about that. I felt quite serene. I thought it was quite fantastic.
Yeah. Well, an amazing game, an amazing end of the season. Amy, thank you very much for talking to us about that. It's been great fun. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. We're back next week with another outstanding match from the history of football. See you then.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.